Now, Hollywood actors under the union banner of SAG-AFTRA are on strike starting this week. They joined writers who began a strike more than 2 months ago. The two major entertainment creators' groups haven't been on strike at the same time since 1960. Basic pay, money from streaming services, and the threat of AI replacing human talent are some of the roots of the disagreement. And while it seemed like SAG-AFTRA negotiators and the studios may have been poised to strike a deal, there wasn't enough major structural change for the actors to accept it. Here's SAG-AFTRA president and actress Fran Drescher talking about the gravity of the strike authorization and the disruption of the entertainment industry.
You cannot change the business model as much as it has changed and not expect the contract to change too. We're not going to keep doing incremental changes on a contract that no longer honors what is happening right now with this business model that was foisted upon us. What are we doing? Moving around furniture on the Titanic? It's crazy.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the actors' strike and the ongoing writers' strike? What stands out to you? Do you have questions about it? Have you worked in that industry? What's your perspective? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Meg James is a senior entertainment industry writer for the Los Angeles Times. I talked to her earlier today. It looked earlier in the negotiations, just a few weeks before the actors' strike started, like things were going pretty smoothly. What broke down?
Yes, this is an interesting development that we had been monitoring. The actors came in really strong. They had a strike authorization vote before they started their negotiations in early June. But things just started, like, it looked like they were making progress early on, both sides have said. But halfway through their talks, the issue of artificial intelligence really started to take a big presence. It really became a big point. And the other point that the studios did not want to give in on was revenue sharing. But there was a moment that Fran Drescher, the SAG president, came. It was in late June, and she had a video from the studios negotiating sort of headquarters saying that they were making great progress. That moment was huge. It was pivotal. Within a few days, a letter was written by A-list actors saying that this is not the year to meet in the middle. No, you know, unless they had a breakthrough transformative deal, they were more willing to strike. So that put the SAG leadership sort of behind the eight ball. They had to come out with a huge deal, and the studios just were not willing to move on certain things, including the revenue share.
And Meg, it seems like this isn't, I think, a usual labor strike where it's, you know, hey, we think it's time to get paid a little more. We want more benefits. You know, that's all there. But there's also, for both writers and actors, this transformational moment, it seems like. You mentioned artificial intelligence. How do we deal with who gets money when things are streamed, streamed originally, streamed later? Can you talk about some of those basic structural things that make this kind of a different moment for studios, actors, and writers?
Exactly. If this was a conversation about higher wages, higher minimum rates, the issues would have been solved a long time ago. But the issue that has been roiling the creative community here in Los Angeles, New York, and beyond is that the streaming model is fundamentally different. It used to be that a television writer and a television actor would work almost 9 months of a year on a TV series. There'd be 22 episodes produced. There was plenty of, you know, fees for the writers to get paid for their scripts and also for the actors per their appearances. But what happened with the streaming model is these streamers, Netflix led the way, decided that, hey, we don't need 22 episodes. 8 or 9, maybe even 7 episodes for a season would be fine. And from there, it really changed how the earning power of these creatives, the writers, the directors, and the actors were paid. And what they found was that they were earning a lot less than they had in the previous model prior to streaming. And that's what's changed the complexion of these talks. And that is also why it has become so, both sides are so entrenched, because that we are looking at profound changes to the industry. And also, people are not making a living wage at the mid-levels and lower levels of the business. And that's concerning, too.
And Meg, people might think actor, and they might think, you know, the big name actors who are bringing home lots of money. Can you talk about, you know, all those actors who aren't, you know, the Tom Cruises and the writers, for that matter, who are kind of living more hand to mouth?
Precisely. I mean, of course, the Tom Cruises, the Meryl Streeps, you know, the Matt Damons, they're making, you know, humongous salaries or fees. They're doing incredibly well. But that is just a small fraction of the industry. Most actors, they you know, sort of try to string job by job by job so they can make a living, so that they can actually earn enough so that they can qualify for the Guild pension and health plans. And I would say easily, you know, 70% of the actors are not even mid-range people. They're actually people just scraping by. In fact, one of our other reporters talked to a picketer for a hotel strike that's going on. And this person worked at the front desk, but they also were participating in the SAG strike because they were struggling to make it as an actor.
Is there any sense of how long these two strikes, the writers and the actors, could go on?
Well, this is a huge and open question, and it looks like both sides are really dug in. For the studios, and Walt Disney Company CEO Bob Iger was very clear about this last week, that this comes at the worst possible time. These studios haven't recovered from the COVID pandemic. Movie theater attendance is way down. And just other parts of their business have really been under strain because they've been spending billions of dollars to try to ramp up their own streaming services to take on Netflix. So they have huge losses. So now that everything is shut down, almost everything, there are still some independent productions that are still going forward. But now that most production is shut down, it's really a stalemate. And I think both sides, unfortunately, we'll have to feel some pain before they will go back to the table. We've heard estimates that they might not even start talking till September, which would mean there would be no more, you know, widespread production for the rest of the year. So this is really a horrible moment in Los Angeles, because when the actors go out, everything shuts down. Caterers, you know, taxi drivers, Uber drivers, you know, hair and makeup, publicists, all these people just see their work dry up too. So the ripple effect is going to be enormous.
And briefly, Meg, as we wrap up, when will consumers of TV and movies start to see the impact of these strikes?
That's a really good question, because so many of these streaming services, so many of these companies have huge libraries and a pipeline of programming that was already in the works. So it might be a while before you start noticing, you know, fewer news shows on Netflix or HBO Max. But for the broadcast networks, the ABC, NBC, CBS, they have already felt it. You know, the late night comedians are off the air. They won't have new scripted shows for the fall. And I think it will really be acute for those broadcast networks, because they're so reliant on fresh programming.
We'll leave it there. Meg, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you very much. You guys be well.
That was Meg James, senior entertainment industry writer for the Los Angeles Times. I talked to her about the latest on the major film and TV actors and writers strikes. Coming up, we'll take another look at the story with an expert on labor from UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this strike? What's behind it? What do you think about it? And what do you think about these big changes in the entertainment industry, the rise of streaming, and maybe using AI language learning programs in the creation of the stuff that we watch? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the actors and writers strikes in the entertainment industry. Michael Childers joins us now. He's a professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers and Department of Labor Education. You could join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to this big strike, the two big strikes in the entertainment industry, 800-642-1234. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Rob.
Last talked to you about 2 months-ish ago when the Writers Union started its strike. Is there a connection between that one and now the actors going on strike?
Yeah, it's definitely warming up to be a hot labor summer. I think definitely the writers, as we talked back then, the writers were sort of the first to go in this triad of contracts that the producers had to negotiate. And yeah, since that strike was called and the writers have been on the picket line, they actually haven't even had any meaningful negotiations with the producers.
I want to go back to, we heard some of the Fran Drescher speech. We played a clip at the top of the segment. Here she is putting this actor strike now in the greater context of labor struggles in general.
What happens here is important because what's happening to us is happening across all fields of labor. By means of when employers make Wall Street and greed their priority, and they forget about the essential contributors that make the machine run, we have a problem.
I think it's easy to think about the entertainment industry as, you know, something unique, something different. Here, she's connecting this labor action to workers in all fields in some ways. What do you think of that, Michael?
I think she's exactly right. And in a way, she's basically, they're far and away on the tail end of the impact of the financialization of our economy. I think most working people in Wisconsin and across the country would say, yeah, this is the stuff that's been happening across the manufacturing sector. I mean, this is a major reason why UPS went on strike back the last time they did in 97, and we may be talking about them being on strike 10 days from now, is the kind of casualization of work, the erosion of benefits and pay that workers have experienced across many industries in the United States. And it's come to Hollywood now. The writers have been facing it literally since their last contract. And now the actors are trying essentially to renegotiate before they start to bear the brunt of these kind of seismic changes to their industry.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think SAG is really going to be a harbinger of what is to come in the entertainment industry, and I think everything's on the table right now, including professional sports. And if the public is more interested in watching YouTubers free, they're not going to pay to go to the theater. And I think with the advent of AI, the industry is realizing that there will be a point where you won't know if it's real or it's animated. And I think the days of blockbuster movies are fewer and far between, and they're too expensive to produce.
Tony, thanks a lot for the call. Tony hitting on a lot of parts of this story here. Michael, let's start, first of all, with something that actors and writers are concerned about, the so-called AI programs that might be filling in at least for parts of the jobs done by writers, maybe actors, and as Tony was hinting at, I think in other lines of work.
Sure. And again, back when we talked about the writers, this was this is the first major national contract where AI is a major point of negotiation. Everyone that's played it all on the internet, familiar at all with some of these, you know, large text-based content AI tools like ChatGPT, for example, or Google's Bard, could see how, with given a prompt, these machines can essentially start churning out text. And for the writers, that became a key sticking point because they want to prohibit its use in certain contexts and put great limits on it in others. And it's the same for actors. And frankly, we haven't talked about it, but for musicians as well, for artists in general, because there are AI bots that can generate all of these things, music, art, and text, and use images and likenesses to, in essence, create a bunch of computerized extras, which would kind of to the point that your reporter from the LA Times was making, you know, most of the people that are affected here are not making tons of money. They're on the low end, and that's really who SAG is trying to stand up for in this contract.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tony. Another big part of the story, Michael, is streaming. You know, it's a different model for distribution of movies and TV shows. We just heard from Meg that's shaking things up. And part of the story there, too, is, you know, if I'm an actor or writer and I want to know how well my show is doing, how many people have watched it on Netflix, I don't know. And they're not going to tell you, right?
Yeah, that's a big part of the issue, no question. I mean, they're facing, maybe a double or a triple disruption in that sense to this industry. And yes, the old model was immediately when you think of television, especially network television, everyone's familiar with reruns, syndication of shows, et cetera, which results in what they're calling these residuals, which is payments to these actors and writers once their show has already been produced and continues to be viewed and used by, you know, to be broadcast. And again, you're mentioning it, both the idea that we don't have a model right now that's been negotiated that in any way rewards the actors or the writers based on the actual numbers of views. But in addition to that, it's unclear when or if any of these programs will be reshown. In essence, they're like property of Netflix, for example. And there's no telling. If Netflix just pulls them, then, you know, there won't be any residuals. So there's no question. And that's, I think, the first quote that you played from President Drescher from SAG. That's what she's alluding to when she talks about the fundamental. You can't have incremental changes when you've had a fundamental shift to the industry. We need a new model that more accurately compensates us as we've been compensated in the past.
Now, from studios, especially the ones that, you know, put movies out that people go to see or theoretically go to see in theaters, they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we're being disrupted, too, by COVID, by streaming. A lot of them have sunk money into trying to have their own streaming services, haven't figured out how to make money doing that, at least not that effectively, given the investments. How much wiggle room do the businesses themselves have?
Well, again, this is kind of back to the financialization point. Just real quick before we go there, though, just to think about it, again, these companies are not like the old school studios anymore. Some of the major players in the media market now are these streaming services, Amazon, Apple, where they don't have kind of this long-term relationship with SAG-AFTRA that the other directors do. It was interesting because Fran actually alluded to this when she talked about why they gave them that extension at the end of June, because in her mind, she was thinking, okay, they're kind of working it out amongst themselves. She was hopeful that it's the old school studios. They're telling the people like Apple, Netflix, hey, fellas, the jig's up. We're kind of going to have to get back to a model where there's a proportionate financial reward for these folks based off of the way it used to work with network. And that didn't happen, right?
Talking to Michael Childers, professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers and Department of Labor Education, looking at the big strikes in the entertainment industry. The main Screen Actors Guild and writers have been on strike, the writers, for a couple months now. Michael, what are you watching for to see if the strikers are successful in getting their demands met, if the studios can live without actors and writers for a long time? What determines a success for either side in a situation like this?
Well, they both have their bargaining goals. And your earlier guest did allude to this. I mean, ironically, it's the streaming services that are best positioned in terms of having more content ready to go in the can, so to speak, versus the broadcast networks where they're, you know, basically this fall, if you don't like reality TV or game shows or watch live sports, there's not going to be much on new for you to view. So there is going to be an immediate, they're already, you know, talking about how they are rescheduling production, both on, you know, television shows and on, you know, the motion pictures. So, you know, in a real sense, had the actors settled, the writers would have been in really desperate straits. The fact that they're both out now for the first time in six decades gives them both more strength.
How much does public opinion matter in a dispute like this, in a high-profile industry?
I think it matters in every case, right? And I know we haven't talked about it much, but there's, you know, again, there's major labor actions occurring across the country, and one that will definitely impact us all, may happen within 10 days, which in terms of we've all seen when supply chains get gummed mm-hmm. up, and that's very, you know, possible if we end up seeing a strike between the Teamsters and UPS, if they're not able to hammer out an agreement. I think, you know, Fran Drescher has done a great job of trying to explain in terms that most people can understand what it is that the actors are trying to achieve in this bargain. And I think she's done a very good job of that.
Time for one more quick call with Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. I'm really concerned that I'm thinking that this is premeditated on the side of the people who don't want to be continuing the union, because back in 2012, I was reading online, the SAG merged their guild or whatever with another mm-hmm. television and whatever group for their union, for the pensions and everything, I guess. And so I'm wondering if it's just all about trying to bust that, like so many unions have been busted. And
gotcha, Gail. We don't have a lot of time. Michael, is this an effort ultimately, you think, on behalf of the studios to bust this big union?
Well, I think that that merger actually did end up making them stronger. And I might quibble a minute with a point that Meg made earlier, which was, I think the solidarity you've seen both across SAG-AFTRA and within all of the entertainment industries, and that actually includes like the Stagehands Union, IATSE, the Teamsters do a lot of work in the entertainment industry as well. And it's been pretty unequivocal in terms of support, because they all understand that they come up together and they'll go down together. I guess the thing I would also note is just, look, if the actors aren't able to achieve their bargaining goals, then they're going to see the same sorts of erosion that other workers have seen in our economy over the last several decades. So,
and we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Michael Childers, professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers and Department of Labor Education there. We talked with him, and we heard from LA Times writer Meg James about the issues at the root of the actors and writers strikes in the entertainment industry. You're listening to Central Time. Now, you've seen the story before. A company, a business, makes a public statement defending the rights of a minority group or markets its products to that group in some way. Then it meets a backlash from part of conservative America. Criticism from government officials, maybe even legislation, organized protests, boycotts, activism from local community groups. That could be a story about self-declared anti-woke protests in 2023. But our next guest says there's a long history of this kind of backlash, with huge similarities in the 1950s and 60s era of civil rights movements and desegregation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of today's boycotts targeting, say, Bud Light for marketing with a transgender influencer, or Target for inclusive clothing lines? Do you see the anti-woke movement as something new, or have you seen instances like this throughout your life? And do you have questions for our guest historian? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lawrence Glickman is a professor of history and the Stephen and Evelyn Millman Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. His books include Free Enterprise and American History and Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He wrote about backlash protests for Slate and is working on a new book about that topic. Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Now, this anti-woke movement, or before that, the anti-critical race theory label, may feel new, but you, in that piece, trace the history back to the response to the Brown versus Board of Education decision of 1954, the beginnings of desegregation. We'll get into some of the specific details, but big picture, what similarities do you see then and now?
Well, that's a really great question. And I think that the similarities are at many different levels. Many of the tactics, like you mentioned, boycotts, are the same, but also many of the frameworks for understanding what was going on, in particular, the idea of inversion, that is, that powerful people were losing their power, the idea that there was kind of a zero-sum equation in which movements for equality were taking power away from those with relative power in society. And most interestingly, from the point of view, I think, of modern conservatism, was the effort to use the state to tame corporations that they saw as promoting civil rights and taking away their own rights. I think a lot of times we think of modern conservatism as an anti-statist philosophy. And of course, that's part of what it is. But when you look at these previous campaigns, which resemble the current anti-woke movement, I think you find a willingness to use all kinds of tools to slow down the movement towards equality.
Let's start there with those government movements. Who was targeted and what kind of things did we see in heavily segregated states in reaction?
Well, at the level of one of the interesting things is that, as with today, one area of debate and one flashpoint had to do with the media, particularly the television networks. And we have to remember that television was relatively new in the 1950s. Kind of television sort of came along coincident with the modern civil rights movement. And segregationists were really on the lookout for the fear that television was pushing an agenda that they didn't like. One of the things you find if you read segregationist newsletters put out by the White Citizens Councils, which was a group formed first in Mississippi shortly after the Brown versus Board decision in 1954, and then spread throughout the South, and then eventually throughout the country. But there were many, many articles about how television programs had an interracial cast, and therefore they should be boycotted. One of the key things that I wrote about in my Slate article was the concern that television networks were censoring the music of Stephen Foster, one of the most popular American songwriters of the 19th century. And what they were doing wasn't really censoring Stephen Foster, but they were maybe changing some of the lyrics that were considered offensive by the 1950s. And I was really surprised at the degree to which Congress took this up. Many local state governments took up the condemnation of television networks, which I think what they thought they were doing was just recognizing that words and lyrics that had maybe not seemed offensive to white people previously were now offensive, and that maybe it was okay to have Stephen Foster songs, but maybe taking out some of the most offensive lyrics from those songs and substituting them for other lyrics. So Congress, you know, there were many hearings about this at the state level, many investigations, many critiques of the networks, kind of similar to what we see in Florida with Ron DeSantis and Disney today, for example.
Talking to historian Lawrence Glickman from Cornell University, looking at corporations getting involved in social issues, backlash to that, similarities between the civil rights and desegregation era in the 1950s and 60s and what's going on now in 2023. You could join in with your thoughts on that, your observations, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We also see in the era you write about, Lawrence, boycotts targeting companies like Philip Morris and the Ford Motor Company. What went into those?
These segregationist protests, some of them took place at the level of the state and government, as we've discussed, but a lot of them revolved around trying to organize mass movements against companies that they saw as promoting civil rights. So the Philip Morris Company, you know, one of America's biggest tobacco companies, gave donations to the Urban League, which was a civil rights organization. And the Ford Motor Company was not directly connected, but was linked in the minds of many people to the Ford Foundation. That foundation spun off from from the Ford Motor Company, but it was founded with, you know, the profits of the Ford Motor Company by some of Henry Ford's descendants. And the Ford Motor Company supported, you know, various kind of social science studies that were kind of investigating the costs of racism. And they also promoted some community organizations that segregationists didn't like. And much as we see today with the boycotts of Bud Light and Target, they tried to organize boycotts of the products of those companies. They also organized boycotts of companies that sponsored the television programs that I spoke about before. If there was a television program with an interracial cast, they might organize a letter writing campaign against the sponsor and encourage people not to buy the products from that sponsor. So it's quite interesting because we often assume boycott is an inherently progressive tool, because at the same time as those boycotts were going on, we have the famous Montgomery bus boycott of 1955-56, which was one of the things that set off the modern civil rights movement. But what I wanted to show in my article is that conservative boycotts aren't new. They've been around for a while. And if you read the justification for those boycotts in the 1950s, you could change a few words, but the justifications are quite similar to today's conservative boycotts.
We also, another parallel you raise is then and now accusations that there's indoctrination of children going on by networks, by corporations, and by civil rights movements. Indoctrination, even the word brainwashing, I think had been recently invented at the time. What kind of things did we hear then?
Yes, there was a lot of concern that, for example, school textbooks might promote human equality. There was, I forget which city, but one of the cities, the mass transit system in that city, maybe Philadelphia, had a series of posters, which had, you know, to our mind, I think we would say very anodyne posters about brotherhood and sisterhood and equality. But the critics saw these as propaganda. And as you said, they frequently use the term brainwashing. They were very concerned about that their children were being educated to subvert their values. And so they talked about that a lot. Stephen Foster plays in here too, because some school districts in their, you know, they would have books, they would buy books of songs for their choruses to sing and so forth. And some of the textbook publishers had also agreed to sort of swap out some of the lyrics from Stephen Foster songs to remove, say, the N-word or the word darky or other words that were offensive and seen as promoting a racist worldview. And there were, you know, strong criticisms of those textbook publishers for sexism, I mean, for censorship and for, again, the idea that these publishers and school districts and municipalities were all engaged in this propaganda war, which, again, many white people saw this as a zero-sum thing, in which these gains of equality were a loss for them. And that's how they viewed it. And they often use very strong language to suggest that they were losing this culture war, very much like we hear the very strong language today about losing culture wars.
And we'll pick up on that point in just a few moments. Lawrence Glickman is with us, history professor at Cornell University, looking at protests and boycotts targeting companies that are seen as taking stands on social issues and similarities between today's anti-woke movement and the backlash to civil rights and integration back in the 1950s and 60s. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see these similarities? Did you live through both eras? Do you have thoughts on what you saw then and now? Do you have questions for our guest about the backlash to the civil rights movement and desegregation? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lawrence Glickman, professor of history at Cornell University. His books include Free Enterprise in American History and Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He's with us for a look at the history of backlash to civil rights and to corporations that in some way supported it, how it connects to today's anti-woke politics. Big in 2023. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Larry, before we go to our callers, I want to pick up on something that the strong language, I would say almost apocalyptic language that was used by some of the people opposing integration, civil rights groups, businesses that they perceived as supporting them. Can you spell that out a little more? What kind of things did we hear?
Yes, I think this is very characteristic of backlash rhetoric, which is that it tends to be apocalyptic. It tends to be, as I said before, zero sum. And I'll just give you one example that I talk about in the Slate piece, which is this is an opinion piece that appeared in the Citizens Council, that newspaper of segregationists in this case in Mississippi. And it said, this is about the whole issue of some television networks voluntarily not using some of the more offensive lyrics when they played Stephen Foster songs. And this opinion piece said, we have almost given professional pleaders like the NAACP power almost equal to that of the early Egyptian kings. Today's Negro agitators are not only setting up their own monuments, but like the Egyptian monarchs, they are destroying the monuments of others and attempting to rewrite American culture retroactively. So this, you know, just strikes me as very, very strong language for what was, in a lot of ways, a relatively minor adjustment to the racial realities of the burgeoning civil rights movement. But you could find a lot of language like this in which there's a tone of grievance, a tone of victimization, and a slippery slope idea, which is that this is only the beginning of a process that is going to continually weaken the power that we have in society. That's the fear expressed by backlashers then and now.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I'm a Civil War historian, and I think you've got to take the same kind of thing, including technology, back to before the Civil War. As John McArdle wrote in his book, technology, abolition rode the back of technology, mainly the railroads, national presses, the steamboat. Abolition rode it west. And there are also, for instance, the 10 Rich Tappan brothers from New York, they funded anti-slavery societies all over the Midwest. It changed. And so once also, if you extended slavery into the Western territories, it became a plantation economic model, which would ruin the free farmer. So it came, as Henry Beecher said, the question is no longer whether the black man shall be free, it's whether the white man shall be free too.
Okay, thanks for the call. And actually, looking back to pre-Civil War era, Larry, I got to say, reading your piece, I thought of, you know, some language, pro-slavery language from the South being very similar. If we take this small step, it's one short step to a destruction of our way of life, echoed in the 1950s and 60s and maybe today.
Absolutely. I mean, in my book on the history of backlash politics, I don't quite go back to the pre-Civil War period, but I start in the Reconstruction era when America briefly experimented with becoming an interracial democracy in the dozen years after the Civil War. And very much that rhetoric is very present. And I thought the point the caller made about markets and media mm-hmm. is very important. One of the things you find in the 1950s is that the Citizens Council movement, much as the conservative movement today, really felt it was important to set up alternative markets for goods they wanted to buy and also alternative media. The Citizens Council had radio programs, television programs, and so forth. And so they really did think that This was a battle they needed to fight on many fronts, and they saw themselves losing out in the general corporate world, which they thought was kind of going over towards the integrationist model that they were opposing.
Thanks for that call, Kay. We're talking to Larry Glickman, historian at Cornell University, about backlash politics, what happens when corporations get involved in social issues. And Larry, now we have, and you draw this parallel in your piece in Slate, a governor who declares a war on woke today in the United States. One of the governors in the time period you cover in the 50s and 60s declares an all-out war on integrationism. You mentioned people perceiving this as a battle, the war rhetoric that we see in both backlash episodes.
Very much. That's exactly right. You know, I think that's kind of a piece with the apocalyptic language, the idea that this is a civilizational battle, that compromise can't be brooked because every compromise will become part of that slippery slope towards the loss of cultural power. It's very familiar to us today, but it really was very much part of the feeling of segregationists in the 1950s into the early 1960s as well. And you find war metaphors constantly in the rhetoric of the in the campaigns against integration.
Larry, the heart of our discussion here is this parallel, this backlash now and then back in the 50s and 60s. Is this, you know, a coincidental social response to different circumstances, or do you see this as one consistent political thread, an ongoing political movement in the United States that, you know, didn't really go away, has just taken different forms over time?
Yeah, that's such a great question, and it's one I'm wrestling with a lot in my book. And I guess the Weasley answer I would give, it's a little bit of both. I do think that that backlashes never go away entirely, but there are moments when they assume a certain kind of cultural power, and I think we're seeing that today. You know, I think every movement is, as a historian, we really pay attention to difference over time as well as similarities. And every movement also is unique and different. And one interesting thing we're seeing today is that most of the boycott movements that I wrote about in my Slate piece were pretty ineffective. But today's the campaign against Bud Light seems, at least in the short run, to have been quite effective, to have really knocked Bud Light off its pedestal. And Anheuser-Busch, the parent company, seems to be really trying to regain the ground that it feels it has lost. So, you know, it's interesting to speculate about how the movement today is maybe succeeding with consumer campaigns, whereas in the past, they weren't always successful. They were, you know, very noisy at the beginning, got a lot of attention, but generally flamed out pretty quickly.
Larry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Lawrence Glickman, professor of history at Cornell University. His piece on the historical background behind today's what's called anti-woke politics. We've got that linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Larry's the author of the book Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America, working on a book on some of these backlash issues we've been talking about. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, an internet watchdog program found social media networks at the center of child exploitation around the world. Find out what's going on and what it could take to change things. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with recipes and advice for delicious non-alcoholic drinks. We'll explore the cutting edge of modern mocktails, and we're hoping to hear from you in that conversation. Now, I like mocktails every now and then. I want something tasty. I don't necessarily want alcohol as part of it. So I've gotten pretty creative with some stuff. Maybe I'll share some of that tomorrow. Want to know if you turn to non-alcoholic cocktails, mocktails, whatever you want to call them. Let us know about it. Email your favorites, maybe even a recipe, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow on Central Time.